Christians in many parts of Europe, subjected to unimaginable misery, frequently asked the same question. Others, in contrast, clung to their belief. It was, it often seemed, all they had left. Whether the hundreds of thousands of Sinti and Roma victims could find succour in religious belief, or felt just hopelessness and pointlessness in their persecution and murder, is harder to know. There were no poets in their midst. Most were illiterate and left no written accounts for posterity of their suffering. Countless human lives purposefully obliterated and leaving little trace beyond memory and oral tradition. Genocide and ethnic cleansing on a gigantic scale were an intrinsic part of the meaning of the war to the German leadership and to the hosts of subordinates in the military, police, and bureaucracy who sought to implement racial policy. For their millions of victims, there could often be no more than blank incomprehension. The bleakest pessimism about humankind would have been, and sometimes was, a perfectly natural response to what they had to endure. Yet, astonishingly, there was more than nihilism. Even in Auschwitz, Beethoven's Ode to Joy was sung. Even in this man-made hell, there was still humanity, still a sense of transcendence that music, if not religion itself, could evoke. People found their own meanings, or lack of them. Is it possible to speak of the meaning of the war for the millions who lived, fought, and died during the Titanic conflict? What did they make of the maelstrom of events that had swept through their lives, changing them forever, often in most traumatic fashion? Plainly, each individual experienced the war in some way that was unique. The war had many meanings, or often none at all. Circumstances, widely differing, dictated experience, and from experience, sometimes a sense of what meaning the war might have. Experiences weren't purely individual. Many were shared, common experiences, often shaped in part by the accident of nationality, others extending beyond nationality, even if frequently conditioned by it and perceived through national lenses. Millions served on widely differing fronts, at sea or in the air, some in occupying forces, others in the shadowy guerrilla war of national resistance. Women joined the armed services in high numbers, hundreds of thousands of them providing essential auxiliary services, playing significant roles in resistance movements and in the Red Army and among Yugoslav partisans fighting in the front line. Civilians trapped in war as never before experienced daily anxieties about loved ones far away in combat. In most of Europe, they also had to adjust to enemy occupation, suffer heavy material privations, and often face the terror of bombing and the traumas of forced evacuations. The character of occupation shaped wartime experience in many decisive ways. The grotesque levels of inhumanity in Eastern Europe weren't directly paralleled in the West, but there too, although differing from country to country, the years of occupation left a searing mark on mentalities. Life itself was everywhere more precarious than it had been. For millions, the war was about little more than survival. Certainly, that is what it meant in the first instance for countless fighting troops of all nationalities. Fighting troops. For soldiers, sailors, and airmen at the point of gravest danger, survival was most usually the sole thought and concern. In the heat of battle, there was no room for reflection. Fear and apprehension were overwhelming sentiments as the guns started firing. Thoughts of loved ones back home, of the need to protect them, and of the need to live to return to them, were strong motivating factors. So too, often, was the need to take revenge for what the enemy had done to loved ones. Beyond fighting for self-survival, loyalty to immediate comrades closely followed as a motive. When loss of life was on such a massive scale as it was during the war on the Eastern Front, and when entire military units were being repeatedly destroyed and reconstituted, group loyalty couldn't have the meaning that it had, for instance, for the PALS battalions that had marched into the First World War from Britain's industrial towns and cities. Nevertheless, self-survival depended in great measure upon the actions of immediate comrades. Self-interest determined, therefore, that the fight for survival was also a fight for the survival of those fighting alongside. Fear of the consequences of not fighting also played its part. Soviet and German soldiers in particular could expect no mercy from their own side for refusal to fight or for desertion. Away from the heat of the battlefield, those in the armed forces, even if they weren't reflective individuals, often gave hints, at least, in letters home or sometimes in diaries, of what, beyond personal survival, they imagined that they were fighting for. A subliminal sense of meaning was, through training, upbringing, background, and long-imbibed shared cultural values, superimposed upon the immediate personal reasons for fighting. The belief that they were part of a crusade to defend Germany from a dire threat from Bolshevism undoubtedly drove the actions of most Wehrmacht soldiers as they poured over the Soviet frontiers in June 1941. It gave them seeming justification for their subsequent barbaric conduct of the war, against civilians as well as the Red Army, and involving the massacre of Jews. "Here Europe ends," one cultured German soldier wrote home to his friend as he stepped onto Soviet soil. Germans were there, in his view, to defend the cultured Christian Western world from the repellent atheistic vandalism of Bolshevism. And though no ideological anti-Semite, the same soldier had imbibed Nazi propaganda about Jewish Bolshevism. He didn't hide his disgust at the Jewish population of some of the villages his unit marched through. A German reserve policeman, a shopkeeper in civilian life, wrote to his wife in August 1941 about the shooting of 150 Jews, men, women, and children. "The Jews are being completely exterminated," he commented. "Please don't think about it. That's how it has to be." Many soldiers watched impassively as mass executions took place. Some took photos. "We watched the show and then went back to work as if nothing had happened," one told his wife. His justification followed quickly. "Partisans are enemies and blackguards and must vanish." The sentiment assuaged consciences, at first sometimes troubled, but soon acclimatizing to what was required, when hundreds of villages were burnt and the inhabitants slaughtered or burnt to death, 600 villages in Belarus alone, as reprisal for real or alleged partisan activity. There were exceptions to the inhumanity, of course. The courageous officers who came to form the backbone of the German resistance that sought on a number of occasions in 1943 and 1944 to kill Hitler were galvanized in their conspiracy by the knowledge of the gross atrocities perpetrated against Jews and others in the East. Misfortune, more than anything, foiled their efforts, but the names of General Henning von Treskow and Colonel Klaus Schenk Graf von Stauffenberg stand proxy for many others nauseated by the knowledge of the inhumanity of Hitler's Germany. Some ordinary soldiers, too, felt uneasy from the start about what was happening. Some from religious conviction inwardly rebelled against the barbarism, or even, on rare occasions, helped Jews. Wilm Hosenfeld, a one-time Nazi party member and stormtrooper who had admired Hitler and fully believed in Germany's cause in the war, became so appalled by what he saw and heard as a low-ranking officer based in Warsaw that he took it upon himself, prompted by his strong Catholic beliefs, to help Jews where he could. Among those he helped to save were the Polish-Jewish musician Władysław Szpilman, whose story much later became well known through Roman Polanski's film The Pianist. "Has the devil taken on human form?" Hosenfeld asked in a letter to his wife in July 1942, after mentioning that Jews were being killed in their thousands. "I don't doubt it," was his answer to his own question. "History knew no precedent," he remarked. He described it as such a terrible blood guilt that you want to sink to the ground in shame. The number of those who behaved so nobly has been estimated at perhaps 100. Perhaps the actions of some others haven't been registered for posterity. But at any rate, the number's small, compared with the figure of over 18 million who served in the Wehrmacht. Most of these swallowed to some degree what they were told was the purpose of the war. All the indications are that the forthright views outlined by Field Marshal Walter von Reichenau, an outright Nazi and one of Hitler's favourite generals, percolated down at least in some degree to the army's grassroots. Reichenau clarified the duty of German soldiers in the East in a general order on the 10th of October 1941. "The main aim of the campaign against the Jewish Bolshevist system is the complete destruction of its forces and the extermination of the Asiatic influence in the sphere of European culture. As a result, the troops have to take on tasks which go beyond the conventional, purely military one. In the Eastern sphere, the soldier isn't simply a fighter according to the rules of war, but the supporter of a ruthless, racial, folkish ideology, and the avenger of all the bestialities which have been inflicted on the German nation and those ethnic groups related to it. For this reason, soldiers must show full understanding of the necessity for the severe atonement being required of the Jewish subhumans." What such German soldiers thought they were fighting for amounted to an opaque vision of a future utopia, a new order, in which German racial superiority and dominance over crushed enemies would guarantee their families and descendants peace and prosperity. By 1944-45, such vague hopes had vanished. But the war still had meaning. That it was fought so resiliently to the end now rested predominantly upon a different ideological imperative: defense of the Reich. The phrase encapsulated not simply an abstract political or geographical entity, but defense of family, home, property, and cultural roots. And knowing what crimes they and their fellow soldiers had committed, above all in the East, fighting on meant holding out at all costs against the Red Army, whose vengeful victory would surely bring the destruction of all that they held dear. The ideological meanings of the war helped, alongside discipline, training, and good leadership, to sustain remarkably high fighting morale in the Wehrmacht until practically the end. For Germany's military allies, the meaning of the war was far less clear, morale far more difficult to uphold. Around 690,000 non-German troops, mainly Romanian, had joined the invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941. In the offensive that met such a catastrophic end at Stalingrad, Romanians, Hungarians, Croatians, Slovakians, and Italians all participated. Nearly 300,000 non-German Axis troops were caught in the Soviet counteroffensive. Hitler had nothing but angry contempt for their lack of fighting spirit. In truth, this did lag way behind that of the Germans, and for understandable reasons. Hatred of the Soviet Union was widespread, but didn't suffice on its own to provide motivational meaning for Germany's allies as it did for the German troops themselves. Germany's allies had no clear future vision of a society or regime for which they thought it worth fighting and perhaps losing their lives. Desertion was commonplace, lack of morale rampant, leadership dismal. Romanian officers treated their rank and file, ill-equipped and understrength troop units little better than dogs. It was no wonder that many of them fought only under duress. Romanians didn't have a real goal. What were they fighting for? Was a pertinent question posed by a former Red Army soldier who had faced them and observed their weakness as a fighting force. Italian troops fighting on the River Don also often wondered what they were doing there. They were far from home, in appalling conditions, in a war that meant little to them. It was hardly surprising that they lacked fighting morale. When an Italian sergeant was asked by a Soviet interpreter why his battalion had surrendered with not a shot fired, he answered, "We didn't fire back because we thought it would be a mistake." Most Italians hadn't wanted to fight. They increasingly felt that Mussolini had dragged them into a war that suited only the detested Germans. Without plain or pervasive ideological meaning, the war lacked for them any strong motivating purpose. It was completely rational that they preferred surrender and survival to fighting on in a lost cause. But with their country occupied by the Germans in the north and the Allies in the south, once Italy dropped out of the war in September 1943, Italians showed that they were ready to fight tenaciously against the occupiers and against each other, for an ideological cause that directly affected themselves, their families, and their homes. What sort of post-war country was Italy going to be? Fascist again, or socialist? For the soldiers of the Red Army, a huge multi-ethnic fighting body, the war had an altogether different meaning. Most came from uneducated backgrounds and had lived in primitive conditions. Three-quarters of the infantry were peasants. Some boys from backwoods villages had never seen an electric light before they entered the military. Reflections on a deeper meaning to the war they were fighting are unlikely to have come readily to most of them. Many doubtless fought because they had to, because they had been left with no choice, because failure to do so would have meant certain death. But fear alone couldn't have sustained such astonishing fighting power and morale of the Red Army from the verge of catastrophe in 1941 to complete victory 4 years later. In fact, morale in the Red Army was close to cracking completely as the seemingly unstoppable German advance went from triumph to triumph in the summer of 1941. Desertion rates were high. So were the rates of murderous retribution on those deserting. But a non-stop barrage of propaganda, the endless stories of German butchery of those they conquered, and, at last, a tale of heroism as the Red Army triumphed before the gates of Moscow, eventually stopped the rot. Soviet soldiers, like those of the Wehrmacht, saw meaning in the war, even if they couldn't articulate it. Underestimating the role of ideology in their motivation would be a mistake. It wasn't necessarily the official ideology of the regime, though this was now attuned to an emphasis upon patriotism. When Stalin addressed the troops on the morning of the Great Red Army Offensive on the Don in November 1942, that culminated in the victory at Stalingrad, he couched it in patriotic terms. "Dear generals and soldiers, I address you, my brothers. Today you start an offensive and your actions decide the fate of the country, whether it remains an independent country or perishes. One witness recalled his emotions that day. "Those words really reached my heart. I was close to tears. I felt a real upsurge, a spiritual upsurge." But it wasn't just patriotism. Patriotism and Marxist-Leninist ideology reinforced each other. The troops had been schooled in Bolshevism. Those who fought at the gates of Moscow, at Stalingrad, at Kursk, knew nothing else. They had since childhood soaked up visions of a new, better society for all. One Red Army veteran, who admitted to dreaming of Stalin like a father and likened hearing his voice to the voice of God, said that, whatever the repression, Stalin embodied the future. We all believed that. This future utopia of the communist motherland was now under dire threat. It could still become reality, but only if Hitler's fascists, who were descending like hyenas to ravage Soviet homelands, kill its citizens, and lay waste to its towns and villages, could be destroyed. It was a powerful message that even gained in potency by the added ingredient of vengeance once the tables had been turned and the Red Army had the frontiers of the Reich in its sights. For Red Army soldiers, what they were fighting was a defensive war, a just war, one that had to be fought and won, whatever the human cost. It was strong motivation. The war had real meaning. For the fighting troops of the West European allies, the war couldn't be reduced to a single meaning. The initial Western allies, Great Britain, France, and Poland, were swiftly joined after the outbreak of war by the British dominions. British and French colonial possessions supplied huge numbers of troops. India alone provided 2.5 million men, mainly deployed in fighting the Japanese, while colonial North Africa came to provide the base for the re-establishment of French military strength after 1942. Czechs, Belgians, Dutch and Norwegians were among the many other Europeans who fought with the Poles and French alongside the British from an early stage of the war. The USA and many other countries later joined the war on the Allied side. In 1942, the alliance against the Axis powers constituted 26 countries, calling themselves the United Nations. The war inevitably had varied meanings for the men and women of such a disparate fighting force, engaged not only in Europe but also, after the Japanese had entered the war, in the Far East, as well as on the seas and in the air. Nor were Allied troops any better than other soldiers at articulating what it was they thought they were fighting for. Letters home usually dealt with more mundane aspects of life in the armed services, mostly sparing loved ones the worst of the hardships, pain, fear and trauma that the troops had to endure. Comradeship was crucial. Longing to return to home and family near universal. Ultimately, personal survival was what mattered. Even if mostly unspoken, there were, however, cultural values and subliminal motivational beliefs that sustained morale and made this a war worth fighting. For the exiled Poles and the Free French based in Britain, and for the citizens of other European countries who joined the Allied forces, the cause was an obvious one. Liberation of their homelands from German occupation. But General de Gaulle, leader of the Free French, didn't for a long time speak for most French citizens. For the people of France, at home and abroad, the war had no single meaning. For the exiled Poles, too, the war had more than one meaning. The cause wasn't just freedom from the German yoke, but gaining in importance as the war progressed, seeking to ensure that a post-war Poland wouldn't exchange one form of servitude for another and fall under the dominance of the Soviet Union. Under General Władysław Sikorski, commander-in-chief of the Polish armed forces and prime minister of Poland's exiled government, some 19,000 Polish soldiers and airmen had been evacuated to Britain from France in 1940, though three-quarters of the number of Poles fighting on French soil had been killed or captured. Polish pilots then made a disproportionate contribution to the Battle of Britain. Less well known is that the Polish cryptographers were also instrumental in working with the British and French to break the Enigma code. They had already broken an earlier Enigma model in the 1930s, which enabled the Allies to read German signals, a crucial factor in eventually winning the Battle of the Atlantic. From 1942 onwards, after Stalin had released tens of thousands of Polish prisoners from the Gulag and re-established Soviet-Polish diplomatic relations, some 40,000 Polish troops under General Władysław Anders fought alongside the British in North Africa, then with the Allies in Italy. Anders himself had been captured by the Soviets and suffered grievous torture at their hands while in prison. Unsurprisingly, he remained after his release virulently anti-Soviet. The gruesome discoveries at Katyn in April 1943 were the plainest of reminders to Poles in exile of the horrors, not just of German, but also of Soviet occupation. The crushing of the Warsaw Rising in August 1944 saw hopes of establishing an independent Poland extinguished. The agreement of the British and Americans at the Yalta Conference the following February that Poland, with reordered boundaries, should be assigned to a post-war Soviet sphere of influence completed the Polish sense of betrayal. For non-communist Poles, the vast majority of the population within Poland as well as in exile, the war started and ended in national disaster. Charles de Gaulle was a little-known junior officer in the French army before 1940. Elevated to the rank of general during the German invasion of Belgium, and soon afterwards appointed Under-Secretary for Defence in the French government, he had, with British backing, established himself by the summer of 1940 as the leader of the exiled Free French, a tiny force of only around 2,000 men and 140 officers. In a series of ringing radio addresses to the French people from London, de Gaulle asserted that the Free French represented the true France. He sought to embody defiance, both to the Germans and the Vichy regime, the government of the non-occupied zone of France following the defeat in 1940, to which he denied any claim to legitimacy. But he had little success until the middle of the war. Many in France, influenced by the Vichy press, saw him as a traitor. The sinking of the French fleet at Mers el Kebir in Algeria on the 3rd of July 1940, on Churchill's orders to prevent it being made available to the Germans, and with the loss of life of 1,297 French sailors, did little to win support for the Allied cause either in France itself or in its colonies. Along with the colonial authorities, French troops in the colonies, far outnumbering those in France itself, were initially loyal to the Vichy regime, repulsing an abortive landing by the Free French at Dakar in September 1940. Only gradually, as war fortunes swung against Germany and Vichy lost popularity, did colonial support move to support the Free French. De Gaulle's fractious relationship with Churchill and Roosevelt and internal wrangles among the Free French leadership were a hindrance to a consolidated opposition to Vichy until well after the Allied landings in North Africa in November 1942. At that point, the Free French forces still numbered a mere 50,000, compared with 230,000, who had until then been at least nominally loyal to Vichy. Only by the summer of 1943, having moved his headquarters to Algiers and gained in standing through his support for the growing resistance movement within France, was de Gaulle recognized as effectively the uncontested head of a government in waiting. He now represented a rival growing in power and support to the Vichy regime, which, from November 1942, when the Germans had taken over what had been the previously non-occupied zone, was more than ever a puppet to the increasingly hated German rulers. British troops were unique among their European allies in not fighting to free their country from foreign occupation. The cause for which they were fighting, the meaning of their war, was in this sense more abstract, less obvious. Overwhelmingly, they backed Churchill as a war leader, but beyond the elites represented within the officer corps, not many shared Churchill's own belief in the meaning of the war, that beyond the fight for freedom and democracy, it was to preserve the greatness of the British Empire. Many colonial troops who fought alongside the British hoped, in fact, for exactly the opposite, for independence of their homelands from colonial rule. Even troops from the British mainland, fighting thousands of miles away in the Far East against a brutal and merciless Japanese enemy, had little sense that they were there to sustain British imperialism. Surviving jungle hellholes, as well as Japanese onslaught, and, all too often, the indescribable horrors of barbarous treatment in captivity, was for most all that mattered. Few of the troops spoke in their letters home about any meaning of the war beyond their own survival. One who did, a British officer, wrote to his parents shortly before he was killed in North Africa, expressing vague ideals that nonetheless almost certainly had fairly wide currency. He was prepared to die, he wrote, for what he depicted as the heartfelt longing of all the middling folk for something better, a world more worthy of their children. This sense that the meaning of the war was to pave the way for a better future was widespread, if often unspoken, among the British forces. It gained voice at home with the publication in November 1942 of the report by the liberal William Beveridge laying out the framework for a system of social security that would offer all British citizens forms of state welfare from cradle to grave. The Beveridge report was widely discussed among the troops overseas, an indication in itself that the war was seen as the gateway to a new society. The pervasive sense that the war wasn't just about defeating and destroying the menace of Nazism, though that was the obvious foremost objective, but about breaking with the old world at home once the main job was done, gave the British troops purpose and helped to maintain morale. It would gain expression at the British general election in 1945, when the war against Germany had been won, that against Japan was still raging, yet the war hero, Churchill, was nevertheless rejected by the votes of millions of servicemen as representing the old class order of privilege, wealth, and position, finally, to be replaced by a fairer society. Utopian hopes, as well as the fight against Hitler's Germany, gave meaning to the British war effort. For some who had served in the armed forces, however, and had started with high hopes, the war had brought disillusionment in politics, in a better future, in mankind itself. William Woodruff had gone from working-class Lancashire during the slump to Oxford University, a pacifist socialist who had become converted to the necessity of fighting Nazism to secure an improved, changed society. Yet, he came back from the war, inwardly changed himself, his optimism dissipated on the battlefield. Before the war, I'd talked about building a new civilization, he later wrote. At the end, I knew how fragile civilization is. It took a long time for the memory of other men's deaths to fade. Many other returning soldiers doubtless felt the same way. Home fronts. The gulf between the fighting and home fronts was smaller in the Second World War than in any previous war. Often, there was no gulf at all. The fronts more or less merged. In parts of Eastern Europe, the rampaging backwards and forwards of Hitler's and Stalin's armies and the spreading activities of partisans largely erased any separate meanings for fighting and home fronts. In other parts of Europe, there was more of a distinction. In differing fashion, the peoples of all the belligerent countries endured a hell on earth, mostly under the jackboot of German occupiers. Only the six neutral countries, Switzerland, Sweden, Spain, Portugal, Turkey, and ERA, known until 1937 as the Irish Free State, along with the mini-statelets of Liechtenstein, Andorra, and the Vatican State, managed to escape relatively unscathed. But even they weren't left untouched by the war. The population of each suffered privations on account of economic disruption and, in some instances, direct blockade, and were even subjected to occasional air attacks. For example, the Swiss towns and cities of Schaffhausen, Basel, and Zurich, through misplaced Allied bombing, causing death and injury to civilians. Nevertheless, each of the neutral countries avoided the worst. The path of their neutrality differed in each case. It was only in part shaped by ideological proclivities. To a much greater extent, it was a consequence of strategic necessity and economic advantage. Switzerland, three-quarters of its population German-speaking, worried about the prospect of German invasion, and eventually exposed on all its borders to the Axis powers, was inevitably drawn indirectly into the conflict. Both the Germans and later the Allies repeatedly violated Swiss airspace, and both sides made use of Swiss banking. The need for food and fuel imports meant it was vital for Switzerland to retain its trade links with Germany. The export of precision instruments helped the German war effort. Swiss banks held large amounts of German gold, much of it plundered from the occupied countries and used to purchase vital supplies of raw materials for the war effort from other neutral countries. And despite Allied pressure, supplies of coal, iron, building materials, and, in the first stages of the war, weapons and military equipment crossed Switzerland en route from Germany to Italy. On the other hand, Switzerland's proximity to Germany meant that it was a ready goal for refugees and escaped prisoners of war. The country took in, though not always willingly, several hundred thousand military and civilian refugees. However, it turned away many others, including over a third of Jewish refugees fleeing Nazi persecution. Swedish neutrality, like Switzerland's, was heavily compromised. Trade was badly hit by a British blockade. This contributed to the substantial increase in Sweden's trade with Germany, already the country's major trading partner in the early phase of the war. Crucial to German steel production were the imports of Swedish high-grade iron ore. Swedish ball bearings were also important to the German war effort, though bypassing the blockade almost as vital to the British war economy. Coal, desperately needed in Sweden, was imported from Germany in large quantities. Neutrality was overridden in allowing the passage of troops and armaments. German troops were transported through Sweden to Finland before the attack on the Soviet Union in 1941. Over 2 million German soldiers in all passed through Sweden between Norway and Germany, and thousands of goods wagons containing armaments and military equipment were conveyed through Sweden to Finland as well as Norway. Especially later in the war, however, Sweden took in thousands of refugees, including Jews fleeing from Denmark and Norway. Sweden also, like Switzerland, provided the Allies with important intelligence. On the Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal, though both officially neutral, differed in their stance towards the belligerent powers. Portugal, Britain's oldest ally, favoured the Allies over the Germans in its neutrality, especially once the war had inexorably turned against Germany. In particular, permission to use air bases on the Azores, reluctantly granted in 1943, meant greater protection for the Allied convoys crossing the Atlantic. In contrast, Franco, despite his later assertions that his astute leadership had kept Spain out of the conflict, had actually been keen to join it on the Axis side. But his price for entry had been too high. He not only had expectations of territorial gains in North Africa at the expense of the French, but also put forward such huge demands for foodstuffs and armaments that Germany couldn't contemplate meeting them. Franco didn't change his ideological preference for the Axis. Important exports of raw materials were sent to Germany. U-boats were allowed to refuel in Spain. And nearly 20,000 of Franco's countrymen volunteered to fight for the Germans on the Eastern Front. But as eventual German defeat became a certainty, and as Allied blocking of desperately needed food and other imports concentrated minds, Franco gradually changed his tune and allowed his neutrality to serve the interests of the Allies. Turkey's anxiety not to be drawn into another ruinous war, and the country's geographical exposure to widening conflict in the Mediterranean, underpinned its neutrality. Early in the war, encouraged by loans and credits of over £40 million to purchase military equipment, Turkey favoured the Allies, though it resisted all pressure to enter the war. And, like Spanish neutrality, Turkey's stance indirectly helped the Allied war effort in the Mediterranean and North Africa. With the German expansion in 1941 reaching to its very borders, however, Turkey entered upon a treaty of friendship with Germany. It was a necessary insurance bet against Germany winning the war. Germany exerted heavy pressure in 1943 to ensure that Turkey delivered increased quantities of chromite necessary for the war economy. But Turkey still maintained its neutrality. It maintained this stance against renewed Allied pressure once the war had turned against Germany. Purely symbolically, since it continued to avoid involvement in any fighting, Turkey finally declared war against Germany on the 23rd of February, 1945. In spite of widespread anti-British feeling among Irish nationalists, ERA's neutrality was tilted heavily towards support for the Allies. Britain was, it's true, deprived of the use of ports, finally ceded to Ireland as late as 1938, that would have shortened shipping lines to the USA. But British ships were repaired in Irish shipyards. Irish airspace was used for coastal patrols. Allied air crews who were picked up were returned, while Germans were interned. And there was much cooperation between the Irish and British governments around the joint interest in the defence of the island of Ireland. Moreover, whatever the official position, many Irish families had close ties with relatives in Britain. Despite neutrality, an estimated 42,000 citizens of ERA volunteered to serve in the war, several thousand of whom lost their lives wearing British uniforms, while around 200,000 crossed the Irish Sea to work for the British war economy. ERA's neutrality had a bizarre coda. The Irish Prime Minister, Taoiseach, and veteran of the fight for independence, Éamon de Valera, little more than a fortnight after expressing his condolences on the death of President Roosevelt, joined an extremely small club of those offering formal condolences to Germany on the news of Hitler's death in 1945. British civilians were the most fortunate of any belligerent country in Europe. It wouldn't have seemed that way to the citizens of London's East End, or the people of other British cities, among them Coventry, Southampton, Bristol, Cardiff, Manchester, Liverpool, Sheffield, Hull, Glasgow, and, in Northern Ireland, Belfast. Suffering under the hail of German bombs in 1940 and 1941, then again in 1944-45, when under attack from flying bombs or V-1s and V-2 rockets. The civilian population of Britain, like people in other countries, had less to eat, had to work longer hours, endure hardship and anxiety about loved ones away fighting, and homelessness in bombed-out areas. They had to bear the deep sense of loss when the knock on the door brought the dreaded telegram to say that a husband, son, father or brother had been killed or was missing in action. Women in particular had to bear the brunt of the new material hardship. They were left to cope with the stringent rationing of everyday foodstuffs that had been part of a staple diet, with looking after children while husbands were away, and often having to balance family commitments with long hours at work. Women who hadn't previously been employed or had been housewives contributed 80% to the addition to the workforce, which grew by 500,000 between 1939 and 1943. The pressures on civilian life in Britain, considerable as they were, nevertheless fell far short of those experienced in practically all other European countries. Above all, Britain wasn't an occupied country. There was no ruthless drain on the economy by German occupiers. There was no forced labour driven off to an uncertain future to work for German industry. Outside the big cities, there was little physical destruction by the war, and even within the cities, the damage caused by the bombs, though severe, was limited to relatively confined areas. Thousands were made homeless, though there was nothing to compare with the flood of refugees and evacuees across much of the continent. Food rationing had a significant impact on living standards, but it didn't remotely approach the famine conditions inflicted by German occupation, abetted by Allied blockade, on Greece, and the German blockade on food supply lines in Holland near the end of the war, let alone the horrific starvation of the population of Leningrad. The black market thrived, though less than in other countries where the material shortages were greater. Not least, the fact that Britain remained unoccupied meant, crucially, that there were no pressures to conform with the demands of conquerors, no gulf between those who collaborated at numerous levels and those who chose to resist in various ways. Britain was quite possibly a society more united during the war than it had ever been before or would be again. The dwindling minority of those wanting to make peace with Hitler's Germany, most prominent in the upper-class establishment, soon kept their own counsel, or were interned like Sir Oswald Mosley and other prominent fascists. But the majority voice wasn't coerced or fabricated, as in repressive authoritarian systems. A broad consensus behind the war effort existed in reality. Morale fluctuated, of course, rising and dipping with war's fortunes, and affected by material concerns such as the availability of foodstuffs. Bombing, too, shook morale, contrary to much later legend, though it didn't destroy it. Around 300,000 people were injured by bombing over the course of the war, mainly in 1940-41 and 1944-45. A fifth or so of those numbers, over 60,000 people killed. Horribly high figures, of course, but far fewer than anticipated, and not enough to undermine the morale of the population in general. There were the usual grievances and grumblings of everyday life, even growing numbers of industrial disputes and strikes, with over 2,000 stoppages and more than 3 million days lost to production in 1944. But, though hardly welcome to the government, the strikes were generally short and, for the most part, about wages and working conditions. They weren't a protest against the war. Whatever the ebbs and flows of morale, there was, for the British civilian population, as for the servicemen at arms, an underlying sense of the justice and necessity of fighting the war. Propaganda naturally played its part in boosting this sense of a just cause. The success of propaganda lay, however, in its ability to build upon a consensus that was already present. Churchill, a highly divisive figure as a reactionary pre-war politician, embodied the consensus, basking in approval ratings sometimes of over 90%. His powerful speeches may not have played the decisive role in boosting morale that has often been presumed, but at crucial moments, such as the retreat from Dunkirk in May and June 1940, they undoubtedly lifted spirits, reinforcing the sense of meaning invested in the war as vital for the survival of freedom and democracy. Churchill's significance can be measured in simple terms by imagining what Britain's fate might have been had its war leader been Lord Halifax, as was so nearly the case. The war also had a unifying effect in the vast hinterland of the Soviet Union that remained unoccupied, well beyond the reaches of the Wehrmacht. The Stalinist regime's shift in propaganda to emphasize patriotic defense, appealing especially to Russian national feelings, even promulgating a concordat with the Russian Orthodox Church, wasn't without effect in helping to stimulate a willingness to suffer immense hardship in the cause of repulsing such a cruel and ruthless enemy. Wartime mobilization of the civilian population was inevitably accompanied by heavy coercion and repression, though the numbers interned in labor camps fell. Where there was any doubt about the loyalty of the population, draconian measures were taken. When a minority in some of the national minorities, the Volga Germans, the Crimean Tatars, the Kalmyks, the Chechens, favored the invaders, Stalin didn't hesitate to deport the entire ethnic community, amid appalling suffering and great loss of life, to the inhospitable wastes of remote parts of the Soviet Empire. Nevertheless, terror and repression can't in themselves account for the extraordinary war effort of the Soviet civilian population. The hardships endured and the scale of difficulties that Soviet citizens had to face are scarcely describable. Around 25 million citizens were left homeless in the wake of the German invasion in 1941. Food, apart from potatoes, was drastically rationed, and almost all civilians had to cope with acute food shortages. Around 1 million people in Leningrad actually starved to death. Even in the rest of the Soviet Union, the urban population existed at little more than starvation level. The black market in unofficial peasant surpluses, held back from the drastic state requisitioning, was, however draconian the penalties, crucial to survival. Despite the near constant hunger, morale didn't collapse. The working day was lengthened, with harsh penalties for any labor misdemeanors. But huge numbers of new workers, housewives, students, pensioners, volunteered for work. Women, especially, were incorporated within the workforce as never before, making up 57% of industrial workers by 1943, and no fewer than 80% of workers on collective farms. New productive norms, sometimes double or triple what had earlier existed, were agreed. It took the best part of 2 years for Soviet production to recover from the catastrophe of 1941. But when it did, it provided the platform on which military victory could be built. People accepted the intense privations because they saw that husbands, fathers, or sons were fighting for the country's very survival. Even where death on a large scale had long been part of the culture, the war brought new dimensions of loss. Scarcely a family escaped it. The sacrifice, material and human, might have undermined morale in a society less accustomed to hardship and death. As it was, the peril that all of them faced should the war be lost created a new sense of community capable of endurance and will that no powers of coercion alone, however strong, could produce. The experience of German occupation varied greatly from one country to another. The Czech lands, the Protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia, as they were labelled, had been under German rule since March 1939, and there was no fighting on Czech soil until almost the end of the war. The economic importance of the Protectorate and reliance on Czech workers was so great that the Germans felt compelled to avoid the draconian racial solutions, expulsion or even extermination of the Slavic population, desired by SS race experts, and to refrain from imposing at first too harsh a regime on the subjugated population. But the climate worsened when, in the autumn of 1941, the head of the security police, Reinhard Heydrich, was appointed Reich Protector to quell growing signs of unrest and opposition. Repression now sharply intensified. It reached a high point after Czech patriots, flown in by the British Special Operations Executive, SOE, succeeded in fatally wounding Heydrich during an assassination attempt in Prague on the 27th of May 1942. His death on the 4th of June prompted ferocious reprisals. Heydrich's killers escaped by committing suicide, but 1,300 Czechs, including 200 women, were executed in retaliation for the assassination. The entire village of Lidice, the name had been found on a Czech agent, was destroyed. Hitler threatened to deport huge numbers of Czechs to the east if there were further trouble. The Protectorate remained thereafter relatively quiet until near the end of the war, when, with the Red Army on the doorstep, Prague erupted in rebellion. In contrast to the early occupation of the Protectorate, Hungary was occupied only in March 1944. When in October that year, with the Red Army advancing on Hungary, the head of state, though since March merely at German behest, Admiral Horthy, announced that the country was quitting its alliance with Germany and concluding a separate peace with the Soviet Union, Hitler immediately had him deposed and replaced by another puppet ruler, Ferenc Szálasi, the fanatical leader of the Arrow Cross fascists. The Szálasi regime lasted only until, after weeks of ferocious street fighting in Budapest, Hungary surrendered to the Red Army in February 1945. But it was deadly for Hungarian Jews, as Szálasi's ferocious Arrow Cross exposed them to a reign of terror that provided a horrific coda to the martyrdom they had suffered under the Germans. In some parts of occupied Europe, far from promoting unity among the subjugated population, the war was bitterly divisive. So acute were the divisions in southern Europe that they gave rise to civil war conditions which overlapped with the war against the occupiers. The brutality of the German occupation in Yugoslavia, the massacres and huge reprisal actions, alongside the sickening atrocities of the unspeakable Ustashi, fostered the growth of two separate big partisan movements. The Chetniks, led by nationalist army officers, who wanted a restoration of Greater Serbia under a restored Yugoslavian monarchy, and the communists, led by the Croat Josip Broz Tito. The partisans, however, fought each other as well as the Germans. The Ustashi, Bosnian Muslims, and Montenegrin and Albanian separatists. Only as the war entered its last phase did Tito's communist partisans, meanwhile supported by British munitions and weapons, come to dominate resistance and establish the basis of post-war leadership in a new Yugoslavian state, the one country in Europe where partisans, aided by the Red Army, could eventually gain control and form a government. For Greeks, the outright plunder, ruination of the currency and size of the material tributes taken by the German and Italian occupiers led directly to famine. The drastic food shortage was greatly exacerbated by the prohibition of food exports from Eastern Macedonia and Thrace, under Bulgarian control since the German invasion, where nearly a third of Greece's grain had previously been grown.